Like Chris, I wish to acknowledge the Whadjuk people, the Noongar nation, my respect to their elders and ancestors, past and present. Right, lovely to see you all here. Welcome. We're going to do a bit of walking, so hopefully that's not going to stress anyone too badly, but I believe there are chairs around if necessary. So if you feel a bit faint, just call Sam and she'll provide a chair.
And we have one wheelchair.
Ah. Okay, this talk may be a little bit different from talks you're used to, where I'm interested in your reactions, interactions. So I hope it's more of a conversation than me going blah, 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 because as my colleagues know, I'm no art historian, and I'm atrocious at dates and names and titles. So if you want to know the date of something or the name of something, there is a lovely catalogue that you can read the details. I'll be talking more about ideas because that's the thing I enjoy the most. So let me draw your attention to over here. Da-da, da-da, da-da. And these wonderful volumes. Yes. Magic. As Chris said, it's 20 years since this gallery opened, but it's 50 years since Curtin University and what was then the West Australian Institute of Technology, WAIT, established an art collection. And in my research in those years at the start of this gallery, I spent many a delightful hour going through these volumes, the minutes of the meetings of various art committees, Art Acquisition Committee in the first instance and Arts Management Committee some years later, of the policies, the ideas, the purchases, the little things that happen behind the scenes. So what I want you to think about when you're looking at the collection as we're walking through, what was it like to be a member of one of these committees responsible for acquiring art for a university? And I know some of you were committee members in the past, so this could bring back some memories for you as well, that the responsibility of determining what is art, what is appropriate for an institute of technology, for a university, what's appropriate for them to acquire? What are the reasons to do that? So imagine you're a member of one of these arts management committees, and how would you respond to a gift, to a curator saying, here's a really wonderful work, to whether you should spend $5,000 on one artwork or buy six? What do you do when a school of art has a graduate show and says, well, you really should be buying graduate work? And you look at the graduate work and you think, is this the state of art today? So I want you to have those ideas in your mind as we walk around, and hopefully I can elucidate some of the issues involved in university art collecting. Yes, so I should have an umbrella, shouldn't I? Follow me. Oh, yeah. Oh, I dropped a note. Where will I be? Haven't lost anyone? Sneaky, came around the back door. Okay, I'd like to start with the this gallery and John Barrett Leonard's selection, who was the first curator of the gallery, and his take on some of the exhibition. You can read his curatorial premise in the delightful catalogue. But what I want to do is, first of all, turn your attention to this wall here. And a collection of objects from the Sepik River. Now, imagine this is the West Australian Institute of Technology. It's the early days of the West Australian Institute of Technology, wait. And there are just a number of schools. There's the School of Art and Design, and I'm never going to remember them all. I think there's the School of Engineering. I think there's the Business School and something else. Anyway, maybe it was Humanities.
General Studies.
Thank you, Philip. You have a young campus. You have an art collection that is guided by the School of Art, where one of the staff members of the School of Art is seconded to looking after and curating the collection, the acquisitions. And your purpose as an institute is to educate. So what is the focus of your acquisitions as a member of the management team? You're here to educate people, to show them what art is, and to really engage with issues of, you know, good art and art practice. Now, the Sepik River collection came, the Sepik River objects came into the collection in the 70s, in the early 70s, and were acquired through one of the members of the Arts Management Art Acquisition Committee, who was also a representative from the State Gallery. And in those early committee days, you can see how the committee was using expertise from outside the Institute, as well as within the School of Art, to help them with their acquisition practices. And these were acquired mainly for their educational purposes, as a way of showing art practice. And as John Barrett Leonard quite rightly asks, what was going on in the 70s that had these objects considered important for an institute to acquire, yet Aboriginal works, like the ones over here and elsewhere, did not have that same currency at the time as what were considered primitive objects like these ones. So they're there established as educational material. Now, secretly, and I can let you all in on this secret, at the same time as these entered the collection, there was a group of Aboriginal work from Arnhem Land that was offered to the Institute. It was rejected. Why would you reject them? Any ideas why you'd reject a collection of Aboriginal art? I will answer that. Oh, yeah, you have a thing?
Oh, no, now I feel bad.
I will answer that by turning your attention to the wall behind you, which are a collection of works that were acquired also during the 70s. Have a look at them. And what are we looking at? Posters, prints, a couple of photographs, drawings, works of a small scale, works in frames. I don't know whether they're the original frames, but let's assume they're the original frames. Now think about the collection. This is a collection that's designed to teach people for the edification of the students, the staff, and the general public who might happen to be walking by. This is a collection that is shown within the buildings, the school, the institute's community, in the hallways, in the offices. It's not a collection housed in a gallery. So think again about the Sepik River collection and think again about the Aboriginal art that was offered at the same time. You've got a little storeroom in what is now the architecture building, downstairs on level one, I believe, a storeroom that's about the size of, I don't know meterage these days, you know, 6 foot by 6 foot. You've got objects in hallways of the buildings. Would you accept a collection of Aboriginal art from Arnhem Land? I see people know. No? Why not?
Storage?
Display?
Are these bark paintings?
Some of them would have been, yeah.
Bark paintings are always slightly awkward to display as to whether to put them in a perspex sort of box or just display them naked.
Yeah.
Also, in general, this is a pure speculation. It may be that whereas with the Suffolk work, they were able to sort of put them in a very clear category of ethnography. Mm-hmm. With the Aboriginal work, it may be that there was an uncertainty into what category. Right. They're a little nervous. Can we accept them as being art in the Western aesthetic sense, or do they go into the ethnographic?
And I didn't prime Simon before this. Well said.
Is there an aspect of sacred
about that? I'm not sure. That's not recorded. But certainly that question of, in the 70s, we start to see the work from Papunya and a development of Aboriginal art as a recognised contemporary practice. So there is that debate over, is it art, is it ethnography? That didn't occur with the Sepik River ones. But mainly it's about curation. That from the minutes of the meeting, they did not feel they had the expertise to look after Aboriginal art, that the curatorial expertise that was required. They didn't have the storage space, and they were really concerned about showing objects in hallways and places where, you know, they were going to get bumped. They were going to get acquired by devious means. They were going to perhaps disappear from view. So one of the important considerations is how do you look after a work? How do you display a work? How do you store a work? So for the early days of the university collection and then Waite's collection, it was very much focused on showing, on education, on acquisitions that could provide some edification for people, for students and so on. There was one other thing within the display of works, and that was the good works, whatever the good works might be, ended up with the official people, the leaders, the chancellors and the deans and all those upper echelon people in the university. So, you know, have a look at this wall, and I don't need to know, but what work would you select for your office and be not prepared to return at the end of the year? And when the audit comes saying, oh, I didn't realise that was part of the university's collection or the institute's collection, I thought that was mine.
Can we quote you on that?
No, you can't. Not at all. But it's certainly an interest when you think about displays and exhibitions and so on, that these are works that were initially very much based within the school. Or based within the university institute, in the hallways, in everyday life. So they had to be robust, they had to be able to be moved quite readily, and in some way show what art was in the 1970s, exemplar works from the fields of practice that the school was dealing in the time. So printmaking, photography, painting, etchings, those sorts of things. Any questions about these? As I said, I can't answer specific art historical ones, but we're all on track at the moment. Let us take another journey. at the main central gallery here. Okay, so the first little section I looked at in the 1970s, the objects from the 1970s, were things that were acquired, purchases mainly that went through a committee system where people sat around a table and determined, yes, we need to buy another Fred Williams, or we need to buy a print by so-and-so, or, as did happen at the time, members of the committee would go on trips to Europe, and on whim sometimes, on advice of others, would purchase things in Europe and bring them back and give them to the committee. So a lot of the posters and a lot of those works were acquired through someone, a committee member, saying, oh, the Institute would like that object, I'll bring it back, and here. Oh, by the way, it cost me $50. So one way is acquisitions, purchases. The other way things enter the collection is through gifting. And Chris Malcolm has curated a selection of works that have been acquired through gifts. And these are really important things. And I draw your attention to the, and I knew I would do this, the Carolup collection. You can read Chris's catalogue essay about how important these are in terms of that social cultural engagement. They are a gift to the university. The works here are a gift to the university from artists. What would you do, though, as a committee member, if you were suddenly given this artwork, this object, as a gift to enter the collection of the university? How do you determine whether to accept the gift? Can you refuse the gift? If it's someone really, really important who your university hopes to curry favour with and says, oh, I've got this object you can have for your university gallery, your university collection, do you go, oh, ooh, what are we going to do now? If we accept it, are we going to leave it in the storeroom downstairs for the rest of our lives, hoping it never sees the light of day? Or are we going to go, wow, that's fabulous, we really need to exhibit that? But there's a caveat, because if you accept that one, you also have to have this or that or whatever. So what do you do as a committee member when you're offered an artwork? It's a rhetorical question. I don't expect an answer. But it does set up really interesting conversations about what is a university art collection. Some things are acquired by a committee, they're purchased. Some things enter via a gift. Over 50 years, how do you start to make sense of that collection, of what goes with what? Does this painting go with that photograph? Does this collection go with those objects? How do you determine what the strengths and weaknesses are? How do you create a policy for a collection? These are debates that the committee often engaged in. So, let us move on. Oops, notes dropped. Another way in which things enter the collection when Ted Snell's curatorial premise in looking at the collection was considering that relationship between the institute, wait, the university, and the art school. And one of the very important ways the collection operated, particularly during the 1980s and 90s, was its connection to the School of Art and the School of Art's end-of-year exhibitions. And there was certainly a point during the 1980s, if I recall rightly, where the committee, the Art Management Committee at that time, started to think, should we separate the collection out into an art collection and a School of Art collection, a student collection? Should we only acquire student work for a period of 1 year and then allow the student to take that work back? One of the reasons was because there were so many works now in the collection that had been purchased through end-of-year exhibitions, and at sometimes pressure from staff within the School of Art to acquire work from end-of-year exhibitions, that the debate around, well, what is a university art gallery's main purpose? Is it to purchase works from their own students, their own staff, exhibit works from their own students and staff? What is the reason for their existence? And so over the 50 years of collecting, works have also been purchased from School of Art exhibitions. And Ted's curated a selection of works from students that have gone on to have really successful careers as artists, recognisable names both locally, nationally, and in some cases internationally. He calls them prescient choices. But as someone reminded me last Friday, it's the tip of the iceberg. What you see here are some of the best works on show. There are also some that are dubious, that you don't see. Works that you wonder, why did they buy that at the time? What was the reason for that really interesting clay sculpture? Why? What were they thinking? That debate around what is contemporary practice? What is art? How can we determine quality becomes quite crucial in a university collection. Prescient choices are really important. And these works, I think, are quite exceptional in terms of what they say about the School of Art, what they say about West Australian art practice. We see exemplar works from a range of practices, from painting, from printmaking, from jewellery, from textiles, photography and so on. Even a bit of bookbinding, artist books, which are important at the moment for me. So the breadth of what is done, taught within the School of Art is visible, but also those debates. What does make an artwork? What is important? And for me personally, one of the nice things to see is so many works by students that I have taught over the years. It's quite a delight. Let's move on. Okay, I've set you with a number of questions around what would you do in these circumstances and these situations. Of here you are, responsible for a collection, acquiring work that are to educate people, that are to show the value of what's taught within the university, to look at contemporary practices and show the best of contemporary practices. But over the 50 years of collecting, You've also come across some really difficult situations and problems. And one of those is the shift in contemporary art practice. It was all very well when art was just painting and maybe a few etchings that you could stick on a wall and show somewhere. But what happens when contemporary practice involves installation, involves technologies? This is Carol Rudyard's video projection. And talking with the gallery staff, they would have liked to have shown an earlier Carol Rudyard work, but couldn't. They didn't have the technology because the earlier work required 3 slide projectors with carousels. How many of you are old enough to remember slide projectors with carousels? The technology has changed. So over the years of collecting, do you have to be mindful of whether we can't buy that work because in 5 years' time there'll be no such thing as a goobablobbly? And how are we going to ever show a work that requires a goobablobbly? So curatorial practices, collecting practices become quite challenged, particularly from the 1990s onwards, where shifts towards contemporary practices, technological changes over what a work of art might be, moves it from just something that can be exhibited on a wall to something that requires installing, something that requires technological proficiency, something that requires space. What do you do? Let's move on. So to extend then that question of technological shifts and changes, this is Julie Goff's work, a lovely two-screen production. You can also sense a shift in the way artists engage with their practice. And I don't mean to disparage earlier artists from the 60s in saying this, that contemporary practitioners now approach their art from a very strong conceptual basis, from a basis in which the questions they raise in their practice extend beyond just a pretty picture and just some aesthetic set of circumstances, to requiring the audience to pay attention, requiring the audience to really sit there and think. And durational work like Julie Goff challenge you in such a way that it's no longer that 3-second looking in an art gallery, oh, I've got it and move on, but 10 minutes of sitting, looking, thinking, sitting. Again, how do you respond as a manager, as a committee member, challenged to purchase works of art? A contemporary work that's going to require technological change, that's going to require an audience to be able to sit and look and think and spend time with the work. How do you do that? Final question. Let's return to the big space, or the bigger space. So what I hope I'm setting up for you is a way of thinking about the University Art Collection. And it's a way of thinking that John Barrett Leonard, when his curatorial premise for this exhibition, started to think about as well. when he looked at the collection, 50 years of art objects, and he looked at what he did in his time as director of the first director of the gallery, how did he respond to the plethora of work from a diverse range of practices? How did he consider what were the strengths and weaknesses of that? And for him, his choice was around that of photography and the importance of women art practitioners, the importance of Aboriginal work, the importance of new technologies. So his selection includes both those early works, but now also works that have arrived in the collection through photographic practices, through Aboriginal art, through important women's practices. In your thinking and looking at the vast array that you've seen here, what would you choose? What would you consider were the strengths and weaknesses, perhaps, of this collection? Let's go to the main foyer and determine this. Are you enjoying this walk? I am. Oh, they're setting up coffee. That's all right. They can set up coffee. Rightio. To end my part in this conversation where you haven't been talking yet because I've been yabbering on, by drawing your focus on the foyer itself and this architectural space. Because one of the important shifts that occur in the Curtin University Art Collection is the establishment of this gallery. Right back in 1968, in the early minutes of the meeting, there is comments about the importance of having an art gallery on campus. You hear it again and again and again. It repeats until finally, in 1998, this gallery gets established. It's listed as an A-class World International Gallery. When you've got a space like this, you no longer have to worry about little framed objects that can sit in hallways in a university building. You no longer have to worry about how am I going to purchase a work and I've only got a storeroom 6 feet by 6 feet. You have space to be able to exhibit 9 of Tracy Moffat's photographs. And I'll draw your attention to that because I was actually on the management committee meeting when this object came into the collection. And it was one of those really interesting discussions around cost and around size and around, well, maybe we should only purchase this one and that one and that one rather than the whole 9. It's a bit expensive, isn't it? How does it fit the collection? It's not really West Australian, is it? So there's a whole lot of debates about what you do. But when you've got a gallery and a wall on which you can exhibit a really important piece of contemporary Australian art by an Indigenous artist, female artist, then you're saying something and you're contributing something to a debate about contemporary art practice. You're contributing something to the edification of students. You're contributing something to a whole range of artistic practices and knowledges about art that a gallery space allows you to do, that perhaps the dean's office or the hallway between the design room and the lithographic room doesn't allow you to do. So you can shift, you can expand, you can think alternative ways about what it is you acquire. So what do you acquire? What do you choose? Do you select only local artists? Do you select only Australian artists? Do you select works that are of international repute? Do you buy one work worth $10,000? Or do you purchase six because you need more work? What do you do? My hypothetical rests there. Questions, comments, concerns, issues? And you all go silent.
I think your question is interesting about it's being offered as a gift, and what do you do? Do you say yes or do you say no? I mean, just say yes. Because it could end up being the frontispiece to the gallery, or it could end up in someone's corridor. It might not please everybody, but it might have just something to offer a particular space. There's lots of it. But obviously you've been at the coalface of having to answer that question, so I'd really like to ask you, now that I've contributed, how do you decide?
Oh gosh. I think that's why you have a committee. Though there is that horror of, you know, a committee decision is always a problematic decision anyway. But I think you do, even in this day and age, have to consider storage and curating it. You know, what does it require for it to maintain its integrity as an object, or as an artwork, over its lifetime? How often is it going to be able to be available for display? Will it just sit holding a space within a very limited space? Because while, you know, the 6 by 6 foot little room in the architecture building wasn't very big, I can assure you the stacks below here aren't very big either, and they're groaning under the weight of art, the size of art objects. So there are questions you'd have to ask. Does it fit the collection too? You know, if you've got a whole raft of photographs, for example, and someone's offering you a gold-plated shoe that's 6 foot, 60 foot high, you know, or what's his face? You know, the puppy fellow, Jeff Koons, are offering you a Jeff Koons thing. You take the Jeff Koons. Damn with how do I exhibit it or how do I store it?
Put it outside
the VC's office. But it's an interesting one, isn't it?
Well, what percentage of the collection is actually displayed as opposed to stored at any one time?
I pass on that one. Yeah, good point. I forgot about one controversial thing as well. You know, what if they're objects that border on the obscene? You know, what do you do in this day and age? You call them art and it's all right. Any other questions, comments? Yes.
Oh,
that's a really good question. How do the artists respond? I'd have to ask some of the artists who've acquired, whose work has been acquired over the years for that. But certainly for an emerging artist to graduate and already have work held in a collection is an important stepping stone. I think a lot saw it as a major, you know, stepping stone to being a real artist, that they've been purchased by somebody. Very important. Crucial.
I guess one of the interesting kind of conversations to have is that with any collection also comes the kind of problem of deaccessioning and how do you shed works that may no longer be part of the collection. Have you ever had to be part of that discussion?
I have in time been part of, you know, what we do with this work. Some deaccession is relatively easy in that the work's deteriorated and really is irredeemable, that, you know, you have to go. Others, I'd leave that to contemporary gallery staff to sort of deal with. But it's a very difficult one because you've got a lot of invested interests, like, you know, the artist, the person perhaps who gave it as a gift. Deaccessioning is quite problematic.
Yeah.
At times more problematic than acquiring.
Always.
Yeah.
We don't deaccession a lot unless it is a straightforward case. You either compromising the quality of the integrity of the artwork, in which case it's an easy process.
Yeah.
Otherwise, there's very few pieces without a deaccession for any other reason other than this one. So once it's in the collection, it's actually really hard to get it out of the collection.
Which makes you think twice about accepting things.
Yeah. It's a really interesting thing. Any other questions or comments? Well, I hope you'll spend time in your own time looking at the collection. And it was in the West Australian, I do read the West Australian arts page, oddly enough, a fortnight ago, William Yeomans said, it was worth seeing this collection several times because each time you see it, you can tell a different story. And so I hope that you'll go and find different stories as well. Thank you for coming.